evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, June 19th, 2015. A UNICEF report says both sides in the South Sudan conflict are guilty of raping and torturing young children along with other unspeakable crimes.
And certainly they are suffering quite a bit of psychological distress. Either having been attacked themselves or having witnessed these atrocities.
And we have a report on international aid. One activist says the help must continue beyond crisis situations.
If the money is given actually through infrastructure, there will be a long-term impact because even the children of these victims will have the opportunity to go to school, and if they are hospitals, they will have an opportunity to access services from these hospitals.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. UNICEF says at least 129 children were brutally killed in Unity State during a three-week government offensive against rebels last month. The United Nations Children's Fund says survivors of the attacks report that young boys were castrated and left to bleed to death. Girls as young as 8 were gang-raped and murdered. Other children were reportedly thrown into burning houses. South Sudan in Focus reporter Ian Bior spoke with UNICEF's communication specialist for emergencies, Christopher Tidy, who says violence against children in South Sudan puts the country at risk of losing an entire generation.
We've had the opportunity to interview a number of survivors, children and families who were displaced from communities affected by that violence. And certainly they are suffering quite a bit of psychological distress, either having been attacked themselves or having witnessed these atrocities, to say nothing of the fact that they've been displaced from their homes and communities. So really, and obviously with children being the most vulnerable, these people have suffered inordinately.
Many continue to say that the conflict in South Sudan is a political one, that it's fueled by competing ideas on who should run the country and how the country should operate. In light of this press release, is it appropriate to continue to describe the conflict as purely political?
Well, I think the bottom line is that, you know, the violence, whatever it's caused or whatever it's caused is having, you know, an impact on children and families who play no role in the politics and in the violence. Apart from being victimized by it, what we do know is that, you know, there have been atrocities committed basically since the start of the conflict more than a year ago, and certainly both parties to the conflict have played a role in that, and that's why we continue to advocate with both sides to protect the rights of children. And to ensure that their well-being is safeguarded and that they're kept safe from violence.
A top South Sudanese military spokesman questioned the credibility of the report. He said that it's not part of the culture of South Sudanese to commit these cruel acts against children. What's your reaction to that statement?
This information was collected through extensive interviews with people who were displaced as a result of that violence and the fighting in those communities. And, you know, those we consider those reports and those testimonials to be credible.
Has UNICEF seen this trend of violence against children in any other states in South Sudan?
Yes. I mean, there are indications that that violent acts have been committed against children in other states which have been affected by the violence. And by the way, I mean, this issue also speaks to children who have been forced to commit violent acts themselves. We do know that approximately 13,000 children are reported to have been forcibly recruited into armed forces and their aligned armed groups. And so it's children who have been forced to commit violent acts and also who may have become victims themselves. And again, that's throughout many parts of the country which have been affected by the crisis. You know, really what we're seeing happening is that an entire generation of South Sudanese is being put at risk. And ultimately, that puts the future of the country at risk when children are growing up amidst this terrible, terrible violence. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves what hopes they will have for the future. And when they themselves become adults and are in more of a position to influence the path of their country, you know, how will they react after having grown up amidst such a brutal conflict?
That was UNICEF's communications specialist for emergencies, Christopher Tidy. He was speaking with Ian Bior about violence against children in Unity State. This past week, international donors, including the United States, pledged an additional $275 million to assist the millions of children and adults affected by the conflict in South Sudan. But do these generous donations ever get to the people who actually need aid and improve their lives? Philip Thonaleu spoke with ordinary South Sudanese and civil society groups and sent this report from Juba.
About 15 children, mostly girls, are dancing and singing songs in Juba's Konyokonyo camp for internally displaced persons, or IDPs. These children are supposed to be in classrooms, but their parents say that is not possible. Joseph Akol is a father of four. His oldest child is 18 years old. Akol says his children have not attended school since South Sudan conflict began in December 2013. He says that is because there are no good schools in Konyokonyo, and even if there were, there are no teachers. Akol says aid from international donors has helped his family, but does not go far enough to meet all of their needs. He says the 6,300 IDPs at Konyokonyo camp face many challenges, besides their children's schooling. There is only one borehole in the camp that provides clean water. There is no health facility, and food rations are not enough to feed most families. UN agencies spent more than $1.8 billion last year to assist 4.6 million people affected by the conflict in South Sudan. This year, humanitarian agencies say they need another $1.6 billion to feed 7.9 million people who are projected to be affected by the conflict. But even if the massive injection of funds and the millions of dollars in humanitarian aid is flowing into South Sudan, the living standards of IDPs have not improved, says Lorna Jemis. Jemis is the executive director of women activism group The Voice for Change. She says donor nations should look beyond providing funds to address crisis situations.
If the money is given actually through infrastructure, there will be a long-term impact, because even the children of these victims will have the opportunity to go to school, and if there are hospitals, they will have an opportunity to access services from these hospitals. And therefore, it will be, you know, a long-term impact for the community.
Mayana Kurukweir is the chairman of Konyokonyo camp, where hundreds of plastic tents with barely a meter of space between them stretch as far as the eye can see. Queer says both international and local humanitarian organizations provide food and clean water for the IDPs in the camp and assist children with educational materials such as school bags and textbooks. But Queer says there is no enough money to buy medicine to treat the many people who fall ill. There is not even a health facility in the camp, and NGOs that provide health services say they are never enough resources, Queer says. Queer says there were 13 NGOs supporting IDPs at the start of the conflict. Today, he says, less than half are still working in the camp. Civic society activist Jemis says funds provided by international donors have saved millions of lives in South Sudan. But, she says, those who are benefiting the most from the funds are IDPs who are sheltering in UN camps.
But there are those who have ran and stayed with relatives, they are not taken care of. So maybe there should be a strategy on how we can identify these people and begin to... And now, as we talk, people are beginning to die from hunger because the market is too expensive. And someone who is not earning anything will not be able to eat nor drink. There is no clean water. People are drinking water from the river.
The IDPs at Konyokonyo camp say the real way to help South Sudanese is to end the conflict. Queer says South Sudanese are wary of violence and ready for peace. He says they even have t-shirts with peace slogans, ready for the day that peace will return to South Sudan. But until that peace comes, Queer says donor funding from the international community will continue to be a lifeline for the million of South Sudanese whose lives have been affected by the conflict. The United States is the biggest single donor to South Sudan, with pledges exceeding $1.2 billion. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
South Sudan's National Police Service Emergency Unit, dubbed the 777, says it's arrested four military personnel linked to criminal activities in Juba. The arrests are the latest effort by the police to cut down on crime in the capital, which some residents say is out of control. Waki Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Lieutenant Colonel Mangar Makeni, commander of the 77 unit, says the police stormed Juba's Nyakuron residential area about 9 o'clock last night after following the suspected criminals for hours based on a tip that came into its emergency call center. Makeni says the two arrested last night carjacked a vehicle carrying 9 passengers who worked for an NGO. Some of the suspects ran away, but Makeni says police were able to arrest the two suspects after tracing the getaway car.
One of them is a major in the army, and the second one is the sergeant in the police. And the other two of last incident, they are all private from the national security.
Makeni is referring to two other military personnel the 77 unit arrested on Monday for a separate carjacking. He says the police recovered the two cars.
During the arrest, we found all those numbers, the original numbers from the company, were removed the same night and changed and put the other numbers, which are not belong to those cars. The signboard, the signpost on the vehicle was also roughed out, which a clear indication of thefts and change of number illegally. All those amounted to crime.
Makeni says the arrests are part of the Ministry of Interior's crackdown on crime in Juba that began last year. The 77 unit was launched as a pilot project. Makeni says the unit has arrested 1,280 suspected criminals in Juba involved in killings, robberies, theft, looting, and rapes. Of that number, Makeni says at least 900 have been sentenced to prison. Despite the crackdown, serious crimes are still happening in the capital, especially at night. Juba resident Wani Michael says the crime rate is down, particularly murders that occur at night, but he says sometimes the 77 unit goes overboard.
They need to be like professionals. They should not end up beating people, and then like when they get you at night, they start to slap you or beat you. That's not good. They first have to get the person and ask where are you going, where are you from. You need to start, investigating the person before they start to beat the person.
Makeni says the crackdown would be more successful if Juba residents would take a more active role in community policing.
If the crises are happening in the area where the people are, and then are the community members to report to the police, say that the police can intervene and handle that situation, rather than people keep quiet when bad things are being done.
Makeni says Juba's poor infrastructure does not help matters.
The roads in the villages, in the town, suburb of Juba town are not names, are not numbered, even the houses are not numbered. That also hinder our operation at night because you call from Munuki. Munuki is very bad. We cannot trace you.
Yesterday, Central Equatoria State Governor Kilemen Wani Konga told the journalists in Juba that some members of organized police units and military forces are getting involved in criminal activities due to their meager salaries. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Members of Sudan's Resigat tribe from eastern Darfur received 218,000 South Sudanese pounds from northern Bahar Ghazal officials as compensation for the killings of four of their fellow nomad tribesmen killed earlier this year. Abraham Agoth has more for VOA from Awil.
The bodies of the four murdered pastoralists were found in northern Bahar Ghazal states, Awil West and North counties. Each season, pastoralists from Sudan often cross over into South Sudan seeking water and pasture land for their cattle. In a ceremony organized by South Sudan's Dinka Mulwal tribe of Northern Barakazali State last Friday, peace and border communities members from both tribes met at Acting Governor Salva Shulayar's office to watch as Northern Barakazal State officials handed over the money meant as compensation for the loss of life of four pastoralists. Mohammed Ali, chairperson of the Peace and Border Committee from the Reziga tribe, said he appreciated the commitment to the following through on resolutions made with their neighboring Dinka Mulwal tribe.
We came to receive blood money for the four people who were killed 2 weeks ago in Kir Adam and Awil West County. We have received 83,000 South Sudanese pounds. We are always thankful to the state government for implementing these resolutions of peace and border issues to encourage peaceful coexistence between Rezegat and Dinka Mulwal. This is very regretful indeed for those who lost their family members.
Three Rezegat cattle keepers were found dead on February 24th at Kir Adam, Payam in Awil West, in Awil North County. Another Rezegat was found dead in Awil West in the following day. To date, authorities have not identified any suspects in the killings. While witnessing the handover of the compensation money, Acting Caretaker Governor Ayad reiterated that the Dinka Mulwal had accepted responsibility of the crimes. He says adhering to the directives of the Peace and Border Committees allows for the peaceful coexistence of the two bordering tribes.
You are all our brothers, Rezegat and Miseria. We all agreed with them during this incident as we requested for 1 month to follow this up. We responded before by paying 20% of this money, and now the final 80% is being paid to you as you had earlier agreed, so that we are implementing peace among our people.
Each year, the two tribes sign a document called the Seasonal Migration Border Relation Communal Peace Accord, with the technical support from the international organizations such as the U.S.-funded Vistas International and Concordis. Each tribe is responsible for the welfare of the members of the other tribe who might be visiting within their territory. The document also calls for the compensation for the loss of property between the border communities. Though Shul congratulated the two communities, he strongly asked the Rezegat representatives to expel people who may call South Sudan rebels operating within their territories. Members of Rezegat and Miseria tribes of Sudan seasonally migrate to South Sudan's bordering states like Warab, Unity, Western and Northern Barakazali states in search of watering holes for their animals. Access to Rezegat land is typically granted in January of each year by ships and community elders with feedback from the Peace and Border Committee members of both neighboring tribes. For VOA News, I am Abraham God reporting in Awil.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudan's Manute Bol was a major player in the U.S. National Basketball Association. His legacy lives on in the Manute Bol tournament. More on that after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you ever volunteered for charity work and why?
Yes, I quite remember when a Muslim mosque that they want to paint it. I volunteered to do some because I just love it.
Yeah, I've done it once. It was in South Sudan. We went for a camp there for refugees in Wau. Yeah, we went there and we helped those kids who were suffering from the thing that took them there to the refugee camps. Yeah, and I've done that because I just feel that I wanted to go and help them. That's what took me there.
Yeah, I have been in one of these refugee schools. So I say volunteer. I was a teacher. It is a high school.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. In South Africa, debate continues over the refusal of the government to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir last weekend. He was in Johannesburg attending the African Union summit. He returned home Monday, this despite a South African court order barring him from leaving until a decision could be made over whether to arrest him. The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Bashir for his alleged role in war crimes and genocide in Darfur. Many AU supporters say the continent should have its own version of the ICC. Otilia Anna Manganiza is senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa. VOA's William Eagle asked her about a change being considered to boost the powers of the court.
Well, the protocol amending the protocol to the African Court on Justice, Human and People's Rights was adopted last year at the June summit in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. It does require 15 ratifications. As of now, there are no countries that have ratified the amendment protocol. There are just countries that have signed it. But those still fall far short of the required 15. Whether or not countries will begin to ratify now in the coming months is something that we're yet to see. But beyond ratifying, the court actually needs to be operationalized. And there are some concerns there in terms of whether they have the sufficient capacity, which includes human as well as capital, in order to actually put this court into practice. But there are also concerns that have been raised around the fact that this protocol includes an immunity provision, which basically would mean that even if it were to come into being, the African court would not, for example, prosecute al-Bashir of Sudan if he remains president, because it only gives it gives immunity to people for as long as they're in office.
Another consideration, I understand, is having some countries to adopt universal jurisdiction to hear international crimes such as war crimes or genocide. One such case is going on now with AU support, I understand, in Senegal, where Hissine Habré is being tried. Is that another possibility, another alternative? And does that also allow states to try current sitting leaders?
While it's being heralded as, you know, one of the success stories, these are prosecutions for crimes that were committed in the 1980s. So it is a long time coming. Whether that would then translate to possibly prosecuting people who currently hold office, that is unlikely. The move on the African continent now is to continue to protect people for as long as they're in office. There are other efforts in various countries towards prosecuting international crimes, some by way of domesticating the Rome Statute, others by way of establishing special chambers like the one in Senegal. The more recent one is in the Central African Republic. It hasn't started yet, but it has been mooted as a possibility that they would establish a special court to deal with international crimes. In many ways, going back to the al-Bashir issue, it's ironic that in trying to get an arrest warrant here in South Africa, the South African civil society were actually invoking an existing law in South Africa that also enables universal jurisdiction. That law was acknowledged by the judges but ignored by the government in flouting the decision of the court to issue an arrest warrant. So the question isn't so much whether countries will have universal jurisdiction, it's whether the courts will have the freedom to exercise that universal jurisdiction.
That's Otilia Anna Manganiza of the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa, speaking to VOA's William Eagle. Basketball teams from all over South Sudan are participating in the Minute Bowl Peacebuilders Basketball Tournament in Juba. The tournament opened today on the fifth anniversary of Bowl's death. Minute Bowl came from the town of Turele. He was a fan favorite during his 10-year career in the NBA. He returned home often, using his fame and earnings as a professional athlete to try to bring peace to southern Sudan and to increase educational opportunities for young people. The competition runs through June 27th. VOA's James Buddy spoke with Bol's sister-in-law, Achue Chol, who helped organize the event. She says after 18 months of conflict, this is the right time to honor his memory.
Manute Bol was a peacemaker, and the situation in South Sudan, I thought about that this is the time that using Manute's legacy will unite us together. All the South Sudanese, they are taking part on this tournament, all tribes in South Sudan.
It must be frustrating for the young people of South Sudan, given that this conflict is going on. How do young people feel, and why do people like you, what hope do you have by organizing this kind of tournament?
The hope for this is peace. I want the young generation to put down the division and come together. So I believe that basketball can unite us. It can bring the young generation together in the court of basketball.
Now, talk to us a little bit about Manute Bol. I know he played a major role in making sure that the country we know today as South Sudan come about. Unfortunately, he did not see the independence, the referendum and all that. So can you tell us a little bit about Manute Bol, the person, who he was?
Manute Bol is a man of peace. He loves peace. All his life, he has been committed to his country, working hard for his people. His dream is to bring better life to his people of South Sudan. Manute Bol would like this young generation to have better life, better education, better country. And basketball was one of his dreams as well. He put all his money towards this country to bring better life for them, better future for better education as well. I thought about it and I thought, let's be a torch for Manute to follow his footsteps and do what he loves. And I'm sure he would have been happy to see today how excited and how happy were the young people meeting in the court of basketball, playing together.
We understand that one of Manute Bol's teams, the Golden State Warriors, which in fact won this year's NBA championship, donated some T-shirts that the children are going to be wearing.
Yes. First of all, let me say congratulations to Golden State Warriors. Golden State Warriors donated 3 boxes of T-shirts, of their own T-shirt, to us. They really did well. We are very happy. We would like that Golden State support South Sudan youth basketball team with more teams for the rest of the future. And also, not only that, the 12 teams that are taking part on the Manute Bol tournament are very happy to say thank you as well to Golden State Warriors and to congratulate them for winning the champion after 40 years.
Achue Chol is the sister-in-law of the late basketball player Manute Bol. She spoke with VOA's James Buddy from Juba. That's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Shaquille Manga by General Paulino.
Minul zayu ya jama shikli manga zatu
We've been listening to General Paulino with the song Shaquille Manga. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening, and have a safe and happy weekend. We hope you join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Say.